Hello, this is Danny Van Leeuwen of Hellcats. I'm with Mary Sue Schottenfels, who's Executive Director of Clear Corporation, Creating Healthy Homes in Detroit, Michigan. Mary Sue is one of my advocacy heroes, and we've known each other for a really long time, I think more than 45 years.
I think so.
You think so, Mary Sue? We met at Wayne State University during the Vietnam War, and you were organizing for something.
Right.
I don't remember what, but you were definitely selling bagels or something. Anyway.
That's right.
So you, why don't you just take a second and tell me about ClearCore.
Okay, so ClearCore is a nonprofit working in the city of Detroit and the surrounding area to work on issues of environmental health remediation. So that's lead poisoning, asthma mitigation, energy efficiency, all things that have to do with health as it relates to housing. And we do everything from advocacy on the state and federal level to working one by one in houses to make sure they're lead safe and reduce asthma risk for children.
So you've been doing this a while, and so what motivated you to go this route?
Well, I'd been a community organizer, like President Obama, for years and years, and at some point I was hired in to do a health project, which I had never really thought that health could have anything to do with classic community organizing, but it turned out that really, as we know, now, and any issue can be organized around. It's just pulling people together and trying to make the best decision with the community about what they need. So we looked at many health factors on the Lower East Side of Detroit where I was working, and lead poisoning prevention came up as a very high indicator in terms of the number of children that were lead poisoned in the city. At that point, 20% or 1 in 5 children were lead poisoned, and that leads to all sorts of long-term consequences for their mental health, for their physical health, for their ability to learn. So we kind of decided to make that a major project, and that grew into a funded project called ClearCore Detroit. And actually, ClearCore is called ClearCore. Clear is community-led education and remediation. And CORE actually stands for the fact that we use AmeriCorps workers. So ClearCore Detroit grew from about 19, 20 years ago into a large million-dollar nonprofit working to remediate lead out of a couple hundred homes a year, as well as doing whole healthy homes assessments and fixes in houses where there's children with asthma.
Wow. So you've been doing this really a long time. So how would you advise somebody who was just beginning advocacy in any health related field or passion that they have? Like, what's worked for you? What would you do differently if you were just getting started?
I'm not sure I'd do a lot differently. I've liked the fact that I've worked in a nonprofit. I have many friends that work in governmental agencies. And while that's still the very good work that we all do, it's so much more frustrating. So the bigger the bureaucracy, the slower everything moves, and the less efficiently everything moves. So I've been really lucky to fell into this nonprofit work and have really found that that's the easiest path in terms of getting things done efficiently. So I would recommend that people look for nonprofit partners that they have that may be interested in either starting a new project or helping expand a project they already have. And then, of course, working for the government can be rewarding because usually the funding is at least slightly more stable, and that can be a benefit. We've really been lucky because we're the only lead poisoning prevention nonprofit in the state almost, or at least the lower half of the state. And we, because of that, and because I think we do run a very efficient shop, money has come to us and we've been able to maintain. But, working in a nonprofit always has the issue of where's the next dollar coming from. So I recommend hooking up with an organization that's strongly embedded in the community and that has relatively stable funding, and then either, like I said, bringing a new aspect to that project's work or just helping expand something they're already doing well.
So you're talking about, as opposed to just like starting out on your own, starting by working with somebody else or with another organization that's already established.
I can't tell you how many people I interview for jobs here whose dream is to start their own either business or nonprofit. And, of course, we always need new blood in the work, but that is a, you know, quite a challenge. And you have to have a large operating budget to start with, even for seed money, so that you know you can survive at least a year without new funding. And so it certainly can be done, and when there's real gaps, I think, you know, it's an option for people. But if I were to start something, a new nonprofit or a nonprofit in a new area, I would certainly spend, you know, 6 months at least in that community seeing who else was doing the work and how can I coordinate and build off of what's already happening. So few things, you know, there's so few new ways of doing things that I think you should start to see what's already out there. And then if there truly is a gap, then, you know, then go for it, but go for it with partners. I think this work is absolutely only as strong as the partners we have.
That's interesting. You know, so, you know, I meet people, you know, in my work who are, you know, very passionate about whether it's, you know, like me, that I have multiple sclerosis, so they're passionate about a disease state that they struggled with or their children have. And, you know, their passion and their energy is very impressive, but they don't seem to have the business experience that they need. So, like, what have you had to cultivate in yourself? I mean, you're executive director, so it seems like, you know, the business aspect is a really big part of your job.
Yeah, it truly is. You have to run a good nonprofit runs like a business. And again, over the years, many people have said we're actually part of a larger nonprofit, so we don't even have our own legitimate 501c3 status. And I really have never wanted to do that because I think there's a real benefit to finding, and this could be a company doing back office work or in our case a nonprofit, and go where their expertise is and use that expertise. You don't always have to be doing everything yourselves to get, you know, recognition and to get good work done. So, for instance, for us, we went to a larger nonprofit and said, can you house us, not physically, but in terms of payroll and personnel matters and insurance. So, again, seeking what's out there to kind of be a part of something that's already stable is, I think, is really important. And, yes, you have to run this like a business, and that's why we picked a nonprofit as our fiduciary that already had a long track record of handling the very thorny things that come up, like personnel issues, like cash flow issues, like insurance issues. So you absolutely have to run it like a business.
So, you know, you said that, you know, if you were going to, you know, start again, you would be spending 6 months or more with the community and trying to understand what's life like for whatever the cause is that you're part of.
Right.
So, how do you now, in your existing nonprofit and advocacy work, how do you, you know, stay real, you know, stay connected to the issues? Because, I mean, it seems like that you've been doing this a long time, and the landscape, well, has the landscape changed? I mean, have you had to, how do you depend on, you know, the people with lived experience in your community?
Right. Well, on some level, the landscape has changed a lot, and on other levels, it hasn't changed at all. Certainly, you know, issues come and go. There's the issue of the day. When we started out, lead poisoning kind of was on everybody's radar. Then it totally fell off everybody's radar. asthma kind of had a resurgence, and now I think lead is more well recognized publicly than asthma. So it does ebb and flow.
Okay.
I think it's very important that you stay, unimpressed and unmoved by the issue of the du jour, and you stay very focused on what you're already doing. In a city like Detroit, where we're trying to, resurrect, and actually in some ways that's going very well in terms of the downtown and midtown areas, but for people in the communities, although I do think the mayor's trying to help those communities, the level of distress and poverty and disenfranchisement is stunning still. And so in those ways, and those are the people we serve, and so those are the people we do relate to. I mean, in my office right now, there's several clients that are looking for services from us, and we're in people's houses every day, and I think we do a good job of staying grounded. I mean, we could have moved to a big office building downtown and other ways kind of take advantage of the stable funding we have, but we're, right here in the community, and this is where we'll stay, and we we have clients in and out of here all day, every day. And so I think that's how you stay grounded. We also learn from our clients that the barriers they're facing, and then we do bring those issues to, say, the city council or the state legislature, because there's things that prevent people from even getting the services we have to offer. For instance, a leaking roof will make it so that they can't get a lead grant, or asbestos in their basement might mean they can't get a new furnace. So we're always looking for documenting and then trying to change policy around barriers that make it very difficult for people to maintain their homes.
So that's an interesting thing you're just now talking about, where policy crosses with,
right.
So advocacy is like, it sounds to me like you're talking about advocacy for individuals, and then you're talking about advocacy for the community. And that, if I'm understanding you, then that advocacy is like trying to affect policy.
Right. Like a good example would be that we have a lot of individual rental property owners, landlords, who have not made their homes their rental properties lead safe. And so we deal with that on many different levels. We work with the landlord and the tenant to try to get a grant to that property to fix it up. But we're also working on a policy level with the city and the state, and actually HUD, to say ex-landlord is not interested in a grant, is not interested in fixing up their house, so what policies and laws and ordinances do we have to put in place to move that landlord to action? And then once we have the ordinance, for instance, in Detroit we passed an ordinance, now we have an enforcement work group that's sole job is to make sure that those ordinances work as best they can to really move that sector of the community to action. And so from learning from individual clients that my landlord's not fixing up my house, I know you have a grant, but I know you need his or her signature, we can't get them interested, so then we have the enforcement mechanism that we've really created so that that we have two different ways of, moving to action on a given property. And so that's how we took it to the advocacy level.
Okay, so you're now talking, about this enforcement work group. So is that, done by employees, or is that done by volunteers? And how do you balance the, your paid staff with your volunteer staff?
Right. So in our we're a pretty small nonprofit. We have about 8 or 10 staff.
Okay.
And one or two staff, and in this case, including myself, staff that group, and the people on that group are employed in some sector, but not by us. So they're volunteers to our efforts. So, for instance, we have, as the chair, we have the Center for Urban Studies at Wayne State. We have the city building department, the state lead department, and then we also have local contractors and the Children's Hospital and a couple of citizens. So a blend of people who come at the same issue from a variety of different places. And what we really try to do is problem solve, like, why isn't the building department working more efficiently to go after these landlords? How can we get that to be a prioritized effort in their department? Or why don't we have a law on the state level that really moves landlords? So let's create a law and let's pass a law, which we did. Mm-hmm. But then how do we make sure that law gets implemented? So we've got everybody at the table that has like a stake in this issue. And that's how we, again, how we move the agenda.
So you're both building coalitions with people and then sort of project managing.
Right.
So that it gets, you know, stuff actually gets done.
Yeah, I am. I'm a part of a couple of coalitions around these issues here, and we do get complimented quite a bit for the sense that we do get things done, both, you know, on the ground and also through any meeting groups we put together, that we have very clear goals. They're very manageable and reachable, and we, you know, really try to every month or two, whenever we meet, we really try to have, you know, something done concretely in those months. So I think that's one reason people think well of our organization, and I think this is a very important point for anybody new in this world, which is, you know, keep your word. From every little phone call you need to return to telling a committee you'll get something done in the next month, that I think we're very thought of as very reliable and strategic at the same time, but to not ever get so big that you forget to make, you know, the phone call back to the resident who is just so stymied by the system. And we spend a lot of time as a staff hand-holding and counseling people on getting them through the variety of barriers that they face. So that's like our core mission.
That's very interesting. So I have one more question, and then I'll let you go. And that is, okay, so now you've been working, doing this work for a long time. So how is it that you assure that it'll continue without you?
That's a really good question and a really hard question. And I've grappled a lot with when I might retire and how best to do transition planning. And I have talked about that with my board, and I've thought about it with my staff, but we haven't really concluded yet whether the best thing to do is to identify somebody a year or two before I want to retire and bring them in, or just bite the bullet and once I'm ready to go, hire and find someone then, and then I stay and train them. So we're really in discussion about the best way to do that. I have a fantastic staff. Each of them could do their own area without me being even in the picture. But in terms of somebody that needs to set direction and policy, that's got to be the director. And so we're in the throes of that discussion right now.
Wow. Well, Mary Sue, thank you so much for spending the time with me. I think this will be very interesting for people who are just embarking in advocacy. It takes guts.
Well, Danny, I also want to say that I've watched how you've maneuvered in your career, and I think the blog you're doing and the advocacy you're doing, you know, which is creating, I think, new paths, is fantastic. And I really do salute the work you're doing around advocating for what's important to you.
Thank you. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Danny. Bye-bye.